on here. Ah, hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2021. I'm now here with Faust. I don't think there's any need to introduce him as such. He's a regular face on Millennial. I've known him for five years.
4 years, yeah.
It was 2016. It was September 2016. Yeah. So we're old friends, and
I'm so proud that we were the first to organize the first speech that you ever gave.
Yeah, and I remember it very fondly. I mean, I was nervous at the time, but I do remember it very fondly because it was a nice dark room with a screen with my logo on it, and it looked really nice. And it was just a great bunch of guys. It was a lovely atmosphere. But yeah, I was very nervous, but it seemed to go well. But yeah, that was a moment in time. And of course, yeah,
different times.
Yeah, exactly. Everything has changed now. Now, you were on last year on Millennial, but I can't remember. I mean, obviously, COVID was a year in by then. Mm-hmm. But I think you've had a lot of thoughts about it this year.
So my point on it has for the longest time been that I don't care about the details. I only care about the broad strokes.
Yeah.
People tend to talk too much about, like, is the vaccine effective? Does it actually work? And how is it? It'll affect people's health. I, from the start, didn't care about that. I have always said that it's a power grab, and that's the main thing we have to keep in focus. And that's kind of what I want to talk about.
Just before we get into it, I think that's the kind of thing that becomes obvious later on, like now. At the time, for the first year, I think it made sense that people were, and also once the vaccine came out, it was natural that people got into that, got their teeth into all of that. Because otherwise, maybe it's all genuine, you know? I think it was natural for people to investigate that.
Yeah, of course. It was the nationalists before February, March 2020 who were worried about it, generally speaking.
Worried about COVID itself.
Signs were in December, October of 2019, on 4chan and such. And we were all stocking up on food and being a bit doomed. And then when it more and more became aware that it wasn't that serious, that's when, you know, people started backing off of that position. Some took longer than others, but, you know, no need to get into that.
No,
there's no point. I've always had those. It felt to me like a power grab. And I think that is exactly what it is. Because, well, to get into sort of the story.
Let me just introduce this. So at this point, we're 2 years into this, and we can start to discern the landscape that has emerged as a result of this change in society, this paradigm shift. So Faust, take it away.
Right. So I have to commend the people in power for how they manage this as sort of a chess player would commend a brilliant play from his opponent. Because, see, the motivation is unclear. We don't quite know why they decided to take this step, but there were plenty of pressures. The environmentalist message was getting quite big with Extinction Rebellion and Greta Thunberg. You had the populists rising in Europe on many places. The economic news had been bad, generally speaking, with inflation and so on. And increasing the amounts of people were putting pressure on the system. And what happened with COVID is the whole playing field was swept aside. It's like you grabbed the chessboard and you threw all the pieces aside and you said, we're now playing a completely different game. All your moves are now irrelevant. That's kind of how it feels to me, because the environmentalists aren't getting any ground anymore in the parliaments. The nationalists aren't getting any ground anymore anywhere in the public or the press or the media. The people who used to support us, the populists, are completely focused on only the virus and the COVID agenda stuff. Nobody's paying attention to any other issue. This is the whole of society has been completely focused around this one single issue.
Can I just intervene? I won't do this very often, but I think it's worth emphasizing this, because nationalism was a rising force, and in some, you know, you could say within France now with Eric Zemmour,
well, more so populism, but yes,
you could say that it's still there, and that is identitarianism of a kind in France with him, but everywhere else, I mean, Austria, Germany, Netherlands, Sweden, Britain, it's not doing very well. And it, because it has been completely swamped by COVID. And for those five years, it was, we can talk about 2016, the alt-right. At that point, the alt-right was ahead of the curve, or at least it felt like we were. And one of the scary things about COVID has been this discovery that actually, no, we were ahead of the SJWs and the progressives and the commies, but the powers that be were 20 years ahead of us. You know,
they had measures and options available to them that we did absolutely not realize at the time.
Exactly.
The populist message. Did you see this in the fact in what the populists talk about now? At least in the Netherlands, but I think also in other places, the populists have pivoted towards being mostly anti-COVID, being mostly about opposition to the measures, and have sidelined their own core messages from the past about migration and harsh measures against criminals and all that stuff. You know, all the classical populist topics. It's all about COVID now. It's all about the QR dictatorship, is what they like to say here in the Netherlands. So in that sense, it's a completely brilliant play, because you've managed to just make every move that your opponents have made in the past irrelevant. Their supporter base has been divided. For example, we've got an event in the Low Countries called the IJzerwaken, Wake of Iron, where thousands of nationalists gather every year. And the attendance this year was halved. Not just because the elderly couldn't attend and lockdowns, but also because there was a profound division between nationalists themselves over whether to side with the government or against the government on vaccinations and lockdown issues. So this has divided everyone. It has made everyone completely focused on this issue. And that's why it's such a brilliant play. And one of the things that, to my mind, this brings up is nationalism still a relevant force? That's one of the things I want to talk about. And whether, because, you know, if you listen to the NRX people, the neo-reactionaries and the more technologically minded side of this sort of dissident sphere, then you could say that they make arguments that the nation state and ethnicity and all these things are becoming superseded by bigger issues like globalism, monetary policy, technology, and so on, which are genuine concerns, and a nationalist position that does not have an answer to that is incomplete. But with this whole COVID thing, it also proves, like, nationalism, does it still hold any appeal to people? Is it still a force, or is it just too much the past for people to still be used? And my personal view on it is that actually it's still a card you can play, but it's only a card in a suite. Your national identity, your ethnicity will always be forces as long as humans are still the way we are, as long as transhumanists and evolutionary pressures don't have fundamentally changed us too much. But will it be the force it was in the 19th century? No, it probably will never be that again. So the way I see it is, for example, we need things to rally around. The flag, the nation, the identity are still very strong forces, at least in the background for a lot of people. And to oppose globalism, you need to use all the arguments you can get. So nationalism would be one of the cards you can play against, and would be one of the ways to rally people to your cause. So I see it more as a lobbying group than as the complete and total answer, one of many forces in opposition against it. Sort of, and the real answer in the end is sort of parallelism, where you try to build as much away from existing power structures and existing leads, because we do not have any other option at this point. They've changed the game. You're an outsider to society. You do not conform to vaccination ideologically and so on. And to my mind, this has also made the whole march to the institutions impossible, because
Introduce that, because some of us on our side thought we need to do our own march through the institutions. So we need to mirror what the Frankfurt School advocated in, what was it, the 1930s, 1920s, and which was implemented throughout the next 50 years. We need to do that. And you know, there was always a question of, well, is that viable given this, the rate of demographic change? You know, by the time 50 years has gone, you know, things will be very different. But now, again, COVID has changed this as well. So go into that.
Right. One second. Let me just switch this off because it's making noise. The whole idea for a long time was that the answer is the march to the institutions. And to my mind, now, of course, they always realized that this was a possibility as a counter to the sitting powers always realized that this was a possibility. But so for a long time, it was just ideological controls. If you did not conform ideologically, at least on the face of it, then your career was very, very, very difficult. But now there's a physical barrier as well. If you are not vaccinated, if you don't have a QR code, you are not allowed to be a participant in institutions. There's a reason they're firing all the top medical personnel, regardless of whether they're skilled or needed, because they're not conforming. And I don't expect this to be different in any other sectors. I mean, the bureaucrats will be the first. The direct governmentally controlled industries will be the first ones to be implemented. But in Austria, there's a 2G law. In the Netherlands, they're debating a 2G law. You can't work without a QR code.
So what's the 2G? What do you mean 2G?
2G is the policy of cured or vaccinated. Otherwise, you cannot get a QR code.
Right, okay.
Yeah. So there's a physical barrier to you having even a career in any job if you have an opposition to the system.
So if you want to, and it's worth saying, I'm sorry to interrupt again, I'll try to do this less, but it's worth saying that if you can't have a career, then that disqualifies the middle class from taking part in our sort of thing, because you won't be financially, economically middle class. You won't have that stature in society. You won't have that disposable income, etc. So, and you won't have that reputation. That means that nationalism would be of a different tenor. Then it would have a different
nationalism. To my mind, has always been an ideology by and for the middle class. Nationalism is for the broadest section of the population of a country, and therefore the people who have the greatest stake in that country, which is the middle class, who are not transnational capitalists, who have ties to family and infrastructure and everything else in that country. Nationalism is very much a middle class tight ideology, and if you look at six countries where nationalist movements were successful, this has always been financed and supported by the middle class, whether it's Germany or France or, for example, Hungary. There's the physical barrier, there's the economic incentives they put against you. So you can't hold down a job. You could certainly not make a career in academia, or you have to be willing to go so deep undercover that you go against your own ideals and principles. And if it turns out you're vaxxed, then you will never be trusted by the people who you're supposedly working for, which is kind of the difficult thing. That's completely swept that option off the table. Again, it's a very clever move that they've done overall. What intrigues me is why they felt the necessity of this, because as you pointed out in the beginning, at first the response was serious from our side and not from the establishment. And it was we who were worried, and they were talking about how we were being racist against the Chinese and worried about nothing. But at some point, that completely changed. So clearly, this wasn't exactly pre-planned, but they seized an opportunity. Now, why exactly the motive was to seize that opportunity, that's impossible to tell. But there were plenty of reasons, probably. Like I said, there were leftist populist movements. There were right-wing populist movements. They felt their power under threat from many sides. And this is a way to ensure it. Now, people say sometimes, oh, they've overplayed their hand, but I don't see it. The resistance in most countries, like the US, has 40 to 45% of people not vaccinated. But in Europe, it's between 10 and 20% in most countries. And they are far more draconian. In the European Parliament, you, as a Europarlamentarian, you're still allowed to attend the meetings if you're unvaxxed. But your employees are not. So your staff is not allowed inside the European Parliament if they're unvaxxed. In Latvia, parliamentarians who are unvaxxed are not allowed to vote on bills are not allowed to enter the parliament, and so on and so on. And they've got the Austrian example. Of course, you've got the New Zealand example. Things are quite extreme. And the resistance has limited itself mostly to people shouting in the streets. tens of thousands sometimes, hundreds of thousands even in Germany. In the Netherlands, there was a protest a few weeks ago, 40,000 people in Utrecht. But as any neo-reactionary will tell you, and any nationalist should tell you, unguided mass energy does nothing. It needs a vector to guide it. It needs elites and it needs ideas. It needs a vanguard, to put it in Lenin's terms. It needs something to guide it. Now, that's where I think nationalism still would have a place in the leadership and guidance of these anti-establishment energies, because 10 to 15, 20% of the population, that's still quite a lot. There's still economic force in there. There's still intelligent people there. There are plenty of crazy people on the anti-COVID thing, but there are also quite a lot of intelligent people. You've got the Great Barrington Reef Declaration with a lot of doctors and Nobel laureates, for example. Economists generally tend to dislike the lockdown measures, even if they don't care about the vaccine so much, but they don't like the economic measures, for example. So there's some institutional and elite opposition to current measures. Not a lot, unfortunately, but there is some. And I think under the banner of nationalism, one could rally a part of this force, especially the more lower classes. You can't unite everyone under one flag. We should have realized that over the last few years when we were doing nationalist activism. You can't even unite nationalists under one flag. But it could be one of many of these sorts of oppositional forces where we sort of agree to not attack each other and just focus energies on the system. But there needs to be some form of communication, there needs to be some form of leadership, and there needs to be some form of vector. And for our case, I just point to Leninist vanguardism, for example, as this force. So I think nationalism for now still has that use, particularly in these times, but we've always had a ticking clock with migration and replacement migration. We've had a ticking clock demographically. We now have a very strong ticking clock in terms of what dissidents can do anymore. How much time do we have to do anything at all? How much time before you're fired from your job? You don't have money, then what, right? So I would appeal certainly to everyone listening here to put some differences aside. I particularly hate Americans, but I'd be prepared to put that, aside.
Let's say that you hate America, not Americans. Come on, at least say that.
Okay, I hate America and the majority of its population.
Okay, so there are exceptions.
There are exceptions, but generally what America represents is completely alien to everything I stand for and believe in.
Okay, all right. That's fair enough. That's fair enough. I think that would even be true of a lot of Americans at this stage as well.
Well, I would certainly hope that. Well, you've got the type of American nationalist who hates America more than I do, and I think that's not quite healthy either.
Yeah, but let's not talk about that because it's a digression.
Well, and worldwide, this is again with the thing with why this is such a brilliant play. You had geopolitical tensions between Russia, China, the US, but all of these countries still are going along with vaccination, right? So dissidents there have to be divided on that issue as well. Like, I've noticed nationalists, few, but there have been saying, well, let's ignore the whole COVID thing. Let's go along with the vaccinations because migration is more important. You've got that perspective, right? And you've got the reverse perspective where they say, well, let's leave the migration aside for now. We need to focus on the whole COVID journey sort of thing. So the division is there. The geopolitical tensions still remain, of course, but it's not like we can try to or hope for those tensions having an effect on this sort of dissident front, where, well, to put it bluntly, we would get financing from the Russians or the Chinese, for example, to oppose American hegemony. So on the whole, that's sort of my analysis. Nationalism has a role to play as a motivator and a rallying force, but we need to play fast. And, well, there's not a lot of time. There's not a lot of us, and other options are running out very quickly. There's pretty much only the resort to parallelism, unifying as much force as we can possibly, so being outside of the system as much as you can, being economically independent from the system as you can, having as much as a power base as you can, whether that's democratically speaking in terms of voters, lobbying power, economic pressure, anything, any kind of power you can unite. We've got a few media, independent media magazines in the Netherlands, for example, things like that, any kind of pressure you can get. And to prioritize unification. And in that regard, I have one project that I've been playing with for a long time, but I've launched more or less. I had hoped to have that ready by now, but I've been focusing on Dodge content mostly lately because we need to get our own guys in line over here. But I want to get the European scene moving together more, communicating more with one another. Of course, conferences are impossible. We can't meet each other.
That's another aspect that we could have brought in earlier, that it's completely, the last 2 years has completely put a stop to what we were doing, which was, you know, doing conferences. I was going to conferences all over Europe. And to be honest, I was a bit burnt out doing that. It's not like I you know, wish I could be doing 5 conferences a year again or whatever, because I don't, honestly. But nonetheless, just objectively speaking, that's a great example of what you were saying. It has thwarted the normal processes of political dissidents,
or of any sort of political life. Like you say, parliamentarians sometimes in some parliaments aren't even allowed to vote. So if you want to vote against any new vax mandates, you're not allowed to go into the parliament to vote against it.
And this is the weird thing about COVID. It's like, well, with the vaccine, there is a sense that if you take it, you're a good person. And if you don't, why would we even want your vote? Why would we want your opinion on this other unrelated issue? You're a bad person.
Yeah, so, but this sort of mobilizing of inside-outside group and blame game, that is not a new tactic.
No, I'm just remarking on it as a thing, something that has been enacted here. Yeah, and I guess that the point is that this is why for a lot of people, it's going to seem like this is just far too much trouble, far more trouble than it's worth. I might as well just get vaccinated because then I can have a life and participate. And this is exactly what they want you to think. Exactly the intention. That just get vaccinated and then you can have a life.
I expect that they will stop the lockdowns and the vaccinations at some point. Maybe next year or so. I can't tell you a date, but I expect that they will stop with this. Because at some point, it's too much pressure. They need to take some pressure off the cooker. And they've already set all the legal precedents they need. They've set the legal and moral and cultural precedents. And they've always got a group to blame for everything that's wrong. So they can take the pressure off a little bit. And then when there's a new virus or something else, they can ramp up everything. Because all the legal precedents have been set, you know. You can exclude people from voting in parliaments. You can exclude people from society. You can put in a night clock. Everything like that has been said. Authoritarian control has been significantly increased. And I don't think they're stupid enough to just keep escalating.
Do you seem to be saying that if they did keep escalating, it would actually lead to trouble for them?
Well, yes. You see increasing amounts of violence in the protests. You see, for example, I've been to a few of these protests in the Netherlands, and you see, for example, a division emerging among the police, where the police want to stop escalations, where you've got this group called Police Against Lockdowns, and you've got the Freedom or Free Corps or Freedom Corps or something like that, who don't want to be involved in fighting again. Like a few weeks ago, 6 people were shot by the police over here, 2 deadly, 4 severely wounded, and hundreds were wounded. And also, several police cars were burnt out and a lot of police were injured. You keep this escalation up, you know, at some point your enforcement arm starts, you know, breaking down. Know what, you have to send in the army? You can't keep up that escalation, but you don't have to. I mean, at least if I were in their shoes, I'd say, well, we'll take the pressure off a little bit. Now. They do it every summer, right? Like the last 2 summers, there were ease of lockdowns, and then over the winter, they increased them. And the main thing is that it won't disappear from the media. It will still keep people occupied and away from other issues. And they've got all the legal tools to go back at it again as soon as it's needed. And they've got a boogeyman. So I think that they don't really need to gain that much more from this.
So can you imagine them laying off the COVID issue and just saying,
yeah, but I don't expect the vaccination status will change, for example.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at this point, as you said, the percentages of vaccinated are very high, 80% to 90% throughout Europe. Mm-hmm. So that 10%, 10-20%, they could just decide to write off. And well, okay, those people just aren't going
to
be.
Yeah, but to violently repress them and keep them out of society is risky. They still have families. They're still a part of the economy. So you just exclude them from a lot of things. And you know, you keep the slow pressure up on them. You know, the nudging, you know, as they call it in sociology. One major one will be if they decide to whether you can have a job or not without a QR code. That would pull a lot of people over the stripe. I don't know if that's an English saying, but it would make them decide one way or the other if they're going to be outside of the society or if they put their family and kids. I, for example, I speak to a lot of people within my employment and so on who aren't vaccinated, but they have children and families, and if they can't have a job, then they would do it. So
yeah, you see, one theory is that the powers that be, well, there are different theories here, that one theory is that they want to eliminate the unvaccinated because that is the control group, if the vaccine has terrible effects on people, then if you get everyone vaccinated, then there won't be an unvaccinated population.
Yeah, but why eliminate such
a comparison?
So why eliminate such a perfect boogeyman?
Exactly. That's the other side of it, is that, well, they'll want portion to remain unvaccinated so that they can blame them for the need to continue the lockdown.
That group will include most of your political enemies, because those will be people who had a precondition to being in a position to everything the system said anyway, like us. And then, well, you've got 100 birds with one stone, and eliminating them brings a lot of costs with it, which would be unwise to take, whereas sidelining them and because if you try to go into politics now and they can make an issue out of you being unvaxxed or opposition to vaccination, well, that loses you lots and lots of voters, right? Even Geert Wilders over here is pro-vaccination.
Really?
Yes.
Oh my God.
Tony Baudet is in complete opposition. He's being sued right now by our local version of the ADL because he compared the process of marginalizing the unvaccinated to the Holocaust. And these group of Jewish organizations and Jewish Holocaust survivors are suing him now for bagatellizing, what is the word in English?
Diminishing the Holocaust.
Yes, trivializing the Holocaust, yes, in a civil suit, because they can't make a criminal suit out in the Netherlands. That's one of those things with COVID, actually. They're passing a lot of laws. For example, trivializing the Holocaust, which was made legal in 2011. There's a new law on the books to make it illegal again in the Netherlands. There's a few laws like this about hate speech, about banning political parties who are anti-democratic. A few of these laws have been introduced over the course of the whole COVID thing without getting too much notice in the press or from other parties because, again, everyone's distracted with the whole COVID thing. So we might be up for seeing bans of political parties because they're making legislation for that.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine them banning parties that are anti-vax, for example?
Yes. The two ones I'm thinking of are the slightly smaller ones, which is the Christian Fundamentalist Calvinist Party over here, which is completely opposed to vaccination because they say vaccination goes against the will of God. God decides whether you live or die, and taking vaccinations is a man-made interruption of God's will. So they are opposed to it. And then there's Forum for Democracy, Baudet, who says, well, it's globalist. You know, all the things that we say in these sort of circles, he says as well. Compares to all, he goes for the rather sort of populist route. Like he says, they're vaccinazis, and they want to rule the world. Klaus Schwab's a Nazi, all this stuff, you know.
I saw a thing on Facebook yesterday because I've started going back to Facebook now and then just to have a look at what goes on, and there was somebody saying that globalism bears all the hallmarks of the Nazis. The Nazis never gave up on world domination, and the ones who survived went over to America, and some of them even pretended to be Jews, and they got into the high up in the financial institutions, and now this is them. The COVID thing is them. It's the Nazis. Yeah. It's the Nazis. Now, I mean, do you want to have a go at boomers?
Do we need to? I think everyone knows why this is wrong.
I guess we could, but I mean, I do understand why people don't like,
I don't like Bobnet or for democracy.
There is a certain pettiness about this. However, I will say about boomers that there is a certain type of person of that generation for whom the Nazis represent, like, there's just nothing worse than the Nazis. And therefore, everything is
boomers. It's sort of a mindset.
That's true. And therefore, everything, not only is there nothing worse than the Nazis, but anything bad is the Nazis. So, like, Islamo-Nazis.
Islamo-fascists, I believe.
Islamo-fascists, and so on. And, of course, that is also a part of what we've seen over the last 2 years.
Well, that fits into my United Front sort of narrative. Where do you know that in the Netherlands, the biggest group that isn't vaccinated is Muslims? Muslims are generally speaking not vaccinated. And whenever I speak with Muslims about this, they agree with me on this. We've always had these one struggle memes, right? And you could put them right in this context as well. I'm not sure I am in support of that. If you go to my channel, I've had a debate with two Dutch Muslims about whether that would be a possibility. But fundamentally, we disagreed. Like, I want them to get out of Europe. They want me to convert to Islam. It's kind of non-compromising positions, you know? So, but there could be at least a ceasefire.
Yeah, and you could at least agree to collaborate on against the COVID thing. I don't know. I don't know if that's if you could. I'm just asking.
Well, they wouldn't be my go-to allies. But I wanted to go back to the whole European cooperation thing. I think that we've been operating far too much parallel to each other. The only cooperation you see among European nationalist movements was among a few conferences which we organized and which you were at, for example. And we had a few European parliamentarian groups, for example, cooperation between the Golden Dawn and a few Bulgarian and Slovakian parties, but very little on the whole. Now, we can't organize conferences, we can't organize meetings, and we probably can't build a European parliamentarian party either. What I've been working on and what I've been playing with for a while is to build at least an online platform for us to be informed about each other, to know what exists in other countries. So we've built this website. It's completely still unfinished. It's called popularis.news. It's hosted in Panama. It's like it's as secure as you can get it. That's why it took a long time to get those foundations right. And our idea is to build sort of a combination of what TRS is and what Countercurrents is for Europe, where you get sort of podcasting and radio shows and so on, and you get articles and more intellectual content, but in each his own language and in English, so that we can know what we are doing among each other. That's the long-term goal. It'll take a while before we really get going on that, but that's sort of what I'm working on right now. I work on Dutch projects to try to get, the Dutch movement together again, because it's been a mess over here, division over COVID, feds, all good stuff.
Do you need any help with that website? I mean, are there people?
Well, we've got a lot of technical staff, and
and
we don't lack funds or anything like that. We've got enough people and things like that. What at some point we need is content and contacts, to know where people are so we can put it on there and to be able to talk to them. It's, of course, impossible to host a forum. It's impossible to make a chat group because it will be infiltrated. So it would have to all go on a known basis. You know someone who knows someone, and you build a network that way. But we need to build networks. That's the whole thing with the parallelism thing. We need to build networks, because if they completely drive us out of society, like I said, I don't expect them to try to exterminate us, but if they drive us out of society, then you need to have You need to have someone who is vaccinated who is willing to do shopping for you. You need to have some source of income, maybe a business who, you know, is willing to forge things or something like that. You've got to consider these options because we are in a very serious position. I think people sometimes underestimate how serious it genuinely is, because I think too many people still play with the idea, oh, I'll just take the vaccine. And I'm outside of all these problems and it'll be over and I'll be safe and I'll just be part of society again. But like I said, I expect this phase to taper off, but I expect another phase to start up again at some point, and then they'll keep escalating. It's always this question of two paces forward and one pace backward.
Yeah, so the next phase would be pretty much the same as this. It would just be separate. It would just, after
well, they escalate, and it doesn't have to be a disease. It doesn't have to be anything like that. They can, for example, if we have an economic crisis, can you imagine what sort of measures they'd take?
Well, a lot of people think that climate change is going to be...
Well, that would be a possible vector.
Because sure. that would enable similar mental processes as COVID, because it's something that affects everyone and your actions affect everyone else, so you have to be controlled.
Well, exactly. Why not? You know, that's one of the things that the Dutch government has we didn't have a government for about 400 days. I don't know if you know, not 400, about 280, actually, something like that.
I didn't know that. I knew that that happened in Belgium a few years
ago. Yeah, we've had it for the first time now. The coalition agreement talks couldn't go anywhere because there were too many different, like the left was decimated the last election, but the center grew and the globalists grew. So they had to form some kind of coalition, and they worked out a coalition now. It's on paper center right, in practice pretty damn globalist, and they are spending €1 billion on climate change things. We've got these silly targets that were accepted in law, was like every car in the Netherlands that's sold by 2025 has to be electric. We've got to have 3 million homes with solar panels, these sorts of things, all kinds of things that are impossible to pay for even if we spent the entire GDP on it. But these targets are there. These are still talking points. But again, those talking points will... Something like that will come after COVID has, you know, lost its relevance after they've... For example, with this Omicron thing. The Omicron thing, all data shows for now that it's far less deadly but far more infectious, which is what viruses generally mutate towards. Anyway, we've had this with the bird flu. We had this with the swine flu. SARS, this is what happened every time. So at some point, you know, too few people will be dying. There won't be enough people in the hospital, so they'll have to take population. But sure, they could pick up climate change. I mean, that's a classic. They've been using it for a while now.
Oh, exactly. It goes back a long way. The reason I mention it is, you know, the things like Greta Thunberg, Thunberg, and Extinction Rebellion, it's current. You know, it was a big thing just before COVID. They're now bringing it back, and so it seems to me that it's something that they intend to use as another control mechanism.
And the funny thing is, I'm an environmentalist. I'm very strongly in favor of green policies. In fact, I support solar panels because, one, it's a geopolitical tool to make us independent from Saudi Arabia, and two, energy independence from Russia, from Saudi, from all the geopolitical connections. And it's better for the environment. Not for countries where they mine all the base materials with child labor, but who cares?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I was really up for recycling. I remember liking the idea of recycling and reusing things, because why would you waste that material? Yeah. It's just insane.
Very conservative mindset. Don't waste.
Exactly. And then pollution, who the hell enjoys the idea of a lovely lake being polluted with waste chemicals? I mean, you'd have to be completely off your head. And then, yeah, climate change. I mean, I'm very skeptical about climate change. I do think that's a political, and has always been a political crusade.
Well, the thing with climate change is they always focus on the really they always focus on gases. In the Netherlands, it's NOx gases, stickstof, that I'm not sure what that is in English. And then worldwide, they talk about CO2, but it's always about gases, you know, that you can't perceive through smell or anything. But the fact of the matter is urbanization is a problem. We have depletion of the topsoils. The diversity of species worldwide is decreasing. We've got shifts in global temperature. Man-made influence on the environment is, generally speaking, not that good, and we could deal with that better. That's not a, I don't think that's a controversial issue. I think everyone on our side should agree with that. In fact, environmentalism has always been more of a conservative and right-wing position. One of the first things the Nazis did was ban vivisection. American conservatives were the ones who installed the national park system, you know,
and it makes perfect sense that conservatives would want to conserve the natural environment. I mean, that it makes sense. It's in a way, it's strange that it became a left-wing issue. It's actually quite strange that that happened.
Well, it became a left-wing issue, and it became neutered as a consequence.
Yeah.
Because, everyone knows the process, right? In the 70s, everything right-wing dropped its genuine conservative and environmentalist and all these other values, and it became capitalist. It became militarists and capitalists and colonialists under the influence of American liberal hegemony, and only a bunch of fringe people and elderly people like the League of Empire loyalists, these sorts of people in Britain who slowly died off, were still in favor of Tolkien. You know, Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, these kinds of people. Everyone knows that process. But it's. I always insist that we can make a complete package as nationalists to sell to the population for the middle class, economic security, opposition to the Federal Reserve and their economic policies, to the environmentally green-minded person, security about the environment, demographics, all these things. I think nationalism is undersold. You can make a very good, consistent ideological, political platform that answers all our needs and is appealing to a large section of the population. But,
it might be that the world...
That's all you said, who cares about the economy anymore? We've spelled 100 million, 100 billion euros this year. Who cares?
It might be that the word nationalism is itself just too tainted at this point and actually useless, in the same way that no one in 2021 is referring to himself as alt-right, because you might as well just call yourself evil at this point, because that's what the word has, that term has come to mean, because the mainstream media have redefined it. And in the same way, the word nationalist, I mean, this might be different in the Netherlands, but in Britain, the word nationalist, again, most people would equate it with evil or ignorant or racist or nasty.
That's mostly because we've had populist politicians who claim to be nationalist. Like, people like to criticize Geert Wilders, and he does a lot of things wrong. Like, his whole pro-vax stance, well, it's not pro-vax, but he wanted to sort of take the issue away. He didn't want to be fighting on the issue of vax because he wanted to keep focusing on migration, Muslims, and so on. So he decided to go along with the vax. That was his strategic decision, and it probably was the wrong one. Maybe electorally speaking, it wasn't, but it was a strategic decision, a tactical decision on his part. But Wilders has normalized nationalism in the Netherlands. It's not for nothing that he gets 10-15% of the votes every election. So a milder course where you keep ramping up your rhetoric, that works, but you need to have the time. And one thing we don't have is time.
Yeah, that is interesting. I didn't know that that he'd done that. And I was preparing to sort of mock him about the vaccine stance there, because it does seem kind of funny that I can imagine him saying, "Well, can't we just continue moaning about Muslims? Why do we have to talk about the fact?"
That sort of is true, though.
But if he has achieved that, making nationalism a legitimate political force, then that is to be
applauded. He has made it considerably less taboo over the years that he's in Parliament. Wilders keeps talking about Reconquista, crusade to reconquer our lands, prohibition of all Muslim, like he wants to ban the Quran, he wants to ban mosques, he wants to close the borders completely, a zero immigration quota, deport as many people as possible. So his rhetoric's pretty harsh. So, of course, you can never know what he'd do if he actually ever had any power. But One thing he has done is normalize that sort of rhetoric in the Netherlands. At this point, that's not that an extreme position to take in the Netherlands. Even some VVD people, for example, four years ago, our Minister of Foreign Affairs said something along the lines of, well, look at all these third world countries. They're failures simply because of the people that are there. And what do you want us to do about it, more or less? Of course, that was still a scandal because it's at that point, it's someone holding actual power. It's a minister. But he still has a job in parliament. He got a new position now. So it's not career ending like it is in some countries.
Right. I suppose I will ask some of the questions that have come in. Hold on a second.
Sure.
Okay. Will Faust put aside his anti-British, anti-English, and anti-American stance now that he's developing this new pan-European network?
I will make some exception for the British, but not for the Americans.
All right.
This is the thing. Like, firstly, we are separated by an ocean. Secondly, we're separated by a culture and language. The British are different from the continent, but still more related to us. America is a different story. Besides, you've got different contexts on many things, different story altogether. You got your own shit to fix. We're not getting interfered in your stuff. Stay out of our business.
Okay. All right. The questioner didn't actually ask about America, but I added it in. So I apologize for that.
My anti-British position is a historical one. I feel it is the duty of every patriotic Dutchman to oppose the English at every turn and to sink every British ship you come across. Of course, if you have a charter from the king. But that's a historical context. At this point, you're one of the worst off countries in Europe in many things. Not that any of us are well off, you know, but I like to joke about these things. For me, it's very humorous. I like the reaction I get from British people because they get very off. But in all seriousness, of course, we have to work together.
Yeah, of course. And actually, just on a tangent, didn't you tell me that you like British comedy?
Blackadder.
Blackadder,
Black Books, Not the 9 o'clock News, all this sort of terrible liberal sort of comedy. I used to find it quite funny, yeah, but I was like 13.
I remember watching Blackadder when I was 5, when it was actually still on. I think I saw the 4th season when it was broadcast, if I recall correctly. And yeah, I've always loved Blackadder. I mean, the thing about becoming red-pilled is that you can end up just hating everything. And I think it is important to retain some levity about life and still be able to enjoy some things, if just for your sanity.
Well, I dated an English girl for a while and I lived in London for a few months, in fact. I know English culture. I've just over the years realized how perfidious it all is and how what a terrible role historically they've played.
All right. Let's not get into that now.
No, I'm not even... But you brought it up.
I did bring it up because I wanted to talk about Blackadder. I'm not even going to disagree with you about, you know, the empire.
I find it, you should, even if you intellectually agree with me, from a patriotic standpoint, you should be forced to disagree with me.
Well,
this
okay,
is, this
I'll
is the attitude you. I take on many things. People can rightfully point out that the Netherlands was a center of Jewish power in the, you know, the tulip era and
the slave trading.
But yeah. I will still defend the Netherlands because it is my country, and it does not matter because everything we did was right, and we did never do anything wrong, except if it's wronging our own people.
Well, you know, it's a complicated thing because I can see that the empire was the start of globalism in a certain sense. It was the start of multiculturalism in a certain sense. Yeah. But then at the same time, that's also a stupid thing to say.
Well, I don't, those things, because I don't, those two things I don't consider to be that problematic. If you'd just been a little harsher in your colonial policies, it would have been fine. Your big problem, as well, not yours because you're Scottish, but the British big problem is the development of liberalism, because they're an isolated island country where they feel far too safe and don't realize how harsh the world really is. And therefore, you develop idiotic ideas like liberalism and democracy. And the development of finance usury in the city of London, which, yes, the Netherlands also played a part in. I will not deny that. But we were never as good at it as the British, and certainly not the Americans afterwards. And then people in the chat will say, but it wasn't the British and it wasn't the Americans. Mm. You played a part in it. We played a part in it. There are no guiltless parties here.
Okay. I mean, we can all agree that, you know, we're all partly responsible historically. And yeah, but nonetheless, we are in but this British situation more so. Now. Yeah, whatever. But we're now in this present day situation, which, yeah, we do need to adapt to and fucking deal with.
Yeah.
And these past grievances are just kind of irrelevant now. Okay. Another question.
Yeah.
Originally a territory in France, France came to govern first Holland. Unionist Orange men in Northern Ireland seems a lingering legacy of this.
You mean William of Orange when he was invited during the Glorious Revolution to England?
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, the Orange men are a legacy of William III. The thing is with William III is that he was three quarters English, and there was not that much Dutch about him. I do still like the guy because he asserted princely authority back over the Netherlands and abolished the parliamentary authority at the time. This is a thing in the Netherlands, like half the time the democratic parliament is in charge and half the time the Orangists are in charge and they keep killing each other throughout the district. I keep hoping the king will declare some kind of crusade against the parliament, but I don't think there's a big chance. But yeah, the Orange men are a result of William III and the Glorious Revolution.
Okay. Alaska Chaga says, I'm enjoying Millennial on Odyssey. Good work. Thank you very much. It's obviously quite different this year. It's a transition, but so far it seems to be going quite well, and I'm also enjoying it, so I'm glad you are too. Thank you for that.
Well, I think we have to be quite thankful about
fantastic stream so far. Really?
No, go ahead.
Sorry, go on, you see. Oh, sorry. What was it you were going
to
say?
Yeah, well, all I'm saying is we have to be quite thankful about software like Odyssey, because of all the supposedly alternative and dissonant software, it's actually working quite well. And I would recommend the listeners, if you want to help out Odyssey, one of the things you can do is buy their native cryptocurrency library, I think it's called, because it's too small to be listed on many of the bigger crypto exchanges like Coinbase. And if there's more money in circulation there...
Yeah, it's called LBC.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's called Library Credit. So the acronym is LBC.
Yeah.
Sorry, go on. Okay, well...
Well, just I think, you know, it's one of the successful formulas of alternative media to YouTube. It's actually working pretty well. It has the streaming functionality, which I did not expect it to be so working so well. So, yeah, we should be happy with them. Of course... How long will that last? Who knows? But if you do nothing to support it, it'll be gone. So, yeah.
Absolutely. This is definitely true. I think all of us live in this age where media appears to be free, both at the, you know, in terms of who creates it, like the content creators, and also who purveys it to you, the distributor, the website, platform. But it really isn't. You know, I have to live, I have to eat, and you know, Odyssey is a platform that needs sustenance. Now, as Faust says, you can buy the LBC credits, and that will help out Odyssey.
Yeah. So nothing in life is free, and if someone offers you something for free, then you're the product, as is a known saying.
Yeah. Indeed. Someone says, fantastic streams so far. Really enjoying them. Food for thought, and hopefully these will bind us together to break down the global homo elites. Yes, indeed. Thank you very much for that. And yes, that absolutely is what needs to happen here. We need to bind together. Because as Faust has said, in between his anti-American and anti-British statements, his crass racism, we do need to come together. We do need to collaborate. Okay. Someone says...
Yes, but that's the thing. I don't like the French. I don't like the Slavs. I don't like the British. But I realize that without one another, we're not going to get very far.
Okay. Someone says, this guy, is giving the best pragmatic points I've heard in a long time. So there you go. I've linked to his channel, so you can go and subscribe.
I have to warn you that I don't make that much content in English anymore. I'm mostly doing Dutch stuff.
Okay. And then another commenter says, in a war, if the enemy is attacking you on multiple fronts, you can't just concentrate on the main assault. You have to give attention to all sides. Otherwise, they'll flank you at your weakest point. All issues regarding the Great Reset and Agenda 21 are necessary to combat to varying degrees.
Yeah, we call this in German, we call the Schwerpunkttaktik. And the counter to that is if you have enough resources, is to reinforce in depth. But unfortunately, we do not have that kind of mind power. So you need to have, you know, Feuerwehrbrigade to put in as much as you can. But I'm getting too much lost in military terminology here. There's the attack on the whole front, yeah, but there is one main issue they want us to focus on. I agree, actually, because what he's saying is true. There is one main issue they want us focusing on, which is COVID. And they've got the whole population and us and everyone else talking about it. And at the same time, in a military context, if there is a main assault, you can't ignore it either. You've got to send what you can to stop it. So you do need to focus on it. At the same time, he's right that you can't neglect everything else. You should still be talking about migration. You need to score all the points you can in this sort of debate on all the positions you can, which is why in my Dutch content, for example, I make videos on economics, on environment, on migration, on rule of law, on the idea of freedom, parliamentarism, the monarchy. You need to expose is not the right word, but to explain that we do have an actual ideology and we don't just hate non-whites.
Yeah, of course.
The government's bad.
Yeah, because that is how our enemies would paint us and do all the time. Okay, here's one last question. Does Max Verstappen have a future in politics in the Netherlands? I don't know who that is. I've never heard of him.
Oh, God, he's a Formula One race driver. And he's won the world prize this year. And he's, I don't know much about it. This is what I've been told by other people. He's very daring, very dynamic, and he takes incredibly dangerous risks. And that's why he's winning. He did refuse to kneel to BLM. He said that sort of nonsense. We don't do that sort of thing in the Netherlands. But he did take the vaccine. So I don't know. I kind of consider him too young to say anything sensible because the guy is like 19. And there's sort of a hysteria about the guy. Like everyone loves him all of a sudden and everyone loves all of Formula One all of a sudden because we've got a Dutch guy winning it now, which is a nice, you know, patriotic outburst in a way. But it is in sports. And I don't have to tell anyone listening to this that sports are very often a way to channel energy away from nationalist endeavors through sort of masculine manifestations that have no real purpose.
Yeah. And that is a big thing.
Which is why I think we need to also talk about sports.
Okay, that's true. I think I'll leave that to other people. That's not my forte.
I like rugby personally. It's not a very Dutch sport, but I played that at uni, so.
I can imagine that. I think you'd be quite formidable. somebody is upset. The previous question that I read out, the guy is upset that I didn't name him. It's Aaron Kasparov. Sorry. The only reason I didn't name him is that I seem to have got into the habit of not naming people. I never know whether somebody would want to be named on stream or not. It's the same with the entropy questions. I don't read out people's names generally because I default to doing that because they might not want their name read out. And it might not be a pseudonym, so you never know what you're doing. So that's why. But Aaron, of course, is well known in the online movement. He is a figure. Yeah. So I probably should have just taken the chance and read out his name. My apologies. I didn't mean anything by it.
Well, he's not the actual Kasparov, otherwise he'd be playing chess.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's not the actual Aaron Kasparov. Okay, so let's wrap this up then.
Flip the script a little bit and see what are you thinking about all these things? What do you think you can do about anything? What are your intentions here? I know you organize Millennial, of course, and you do your podcast, which is useful content. But the British movement seems kind of...
I don't know. You see, I've really lost interest in the issues that we used to talk about in the movement, and that partly because I talked about them so much and I've said everything that I have to say about it. And I don't see myself as a political activist or a propagandist. I see myself as a commentator. And so there's nothing fresh for me in those topics.
You used to say you're an artist, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I wouldn't see. I'm always nervous about applying that word to myself because it sounds pretentious. But certainly, anyone who watched the Millennial trailer this year would understand that. Yeah, I'm probably someone who has an art school background, and I do value that, and I enjoy that.
Well, I think that one of the things that we've got too many ideas and too many people on the streets, but we don't have a lot of aesthetics or artists. And in my idea, quite a lot of what made nationalism in the 19th century exactly what it was is aesthetic. Art movements have huge energy to them, whether it's for the English, for example, the music of Elgar, or Wagner for the Germans, or you've got the paintings of Delacroix for the French, or things like this. Art brings energy and movement and dynamicism to these sorts of ideas. It makes them physical, it makes them visualizable. So I think artists are actually a very valuable contribution. We don't have enough of them. So we could use more art.
Yeah, I mean, part of that is that the reason for why we have so few is that the art schools are, yeah, the epicenters of progressivism.
Do you learn to make art in an art school?
No. I didn't learn much at all. And I don't think many people do actually learn much in art school. Except for they absorb the politics. They absorb the subtle political, and nowadays not so subtle, political indoctrination. But what I can do, you know, I don't know. You see, I like the format that I've arrived at this year with the Telegram shows. I don't know whether I'll continue that next year or not. I do have other ideas, but for now, at least, that format enabled me to break the writer's block that I'd had for 2 or 3 years. So
yeah, I know. I know what I knew that you were sort of burned out with all this stuff and that you didn't really know where to take it. I think, well, life has a way of giving you motivation and circumstances being what they are.
I mean, I found the whole COVID thing, lockdown, I found fascinating intellectually. Mm-hmm. And it's, but, you know, again, eventually that will be exhausted as well. I don't see that happening anytime soon. You know, Morgoth recently said that he'd said pretty much all he's got to say about COVID. I don't feel like I'm at that point at all.
I've felt that way a long time. I felt more or less since I took the position that it's just a government power grab, that I don't need to know anything more because that's what it is. And whether the vaccine X or Y works better or not, or whether variant B
That's details.
Details in the margin to me.
Yeah, yeah. I agree that those details don't particularly matter. And it's the equivalent of discussing the disagreements between politicians. It's just irrelevant.
When you read an adventure story and you've got, for example, like the aftermath of the Lord of the Rings story, where they're back in the Shire and they can't really ever come back because they have too many experiences that are outside of the realm of the normal people around them. As a dissident, you're sort of that, you know, you've got that experience. You're never going to be able to live that normal life anymore because things are too different. You've tasted too much of the well of knowledge in many ways. You've had experiences people will never have in their normal lives. So even if you wanted to settle down on a farm, can you really have your peace? It's the same way I think about, for example, does an industrialist or a business magnate or a politician ever really retire? Because can you ever really give up that sort of taste of influence and power and connections, right? Greta Thunberg, I think, was interviewed, or someone like her a while ago, where she was regretting that she had all this attention, media attention and power and influence, and now she was ignored, and that it feels very hollow. I kind of imagine that that is what would happen if you let these things go. I don't think you could ever stop in a way.
Yeah, yeah. There's so much that could be said about this. And I'm not used to, see, with millennial, I always assume it's going to be about the guests. So I'm not primed to talk about myself.
I know. That's why I'm doing it the other way around.
Yeah. Well, maybe we could arrange an interview because it's something I was wanting to do was get people to interview me in January. So maybe we could do that. It's a big topic. I think I would miss what I've had, but the reality is that a lot of what I had is gone now. I mean, you know, when you're not on YouTube anymore, that is it. It's a different life. And it's the same when you lose Twitter. That is a big bloody thing. Now, I'm not going to bemoan it. I did that. I did that 3 years ago. But it is Tell just a reality. It. Yeah, exactly. I don't want to go on about it again.
I believe we met in person around about that time, and it was one of the few things you could talk about at the time.
Yeah. At the time, it was I was in a bad way in general at that time, and you know that's why it hit me so hard. But anyway, it's a big loss, and you only realize how big a loss it is as you know years pass, and you're realizing that you're not as central to the movement as you once were, and that's just because people don't find you anymore. They like most people, there is an inertia. They don't go to Odyssey. They don't go to Telegram. It's unfortunate, but it's the way they are. It's something about human nature.
I've experienced it as a little bit liberating in a way because I was, of course, involved in organizing more deeply into the politics and the getting the things going off the ground and all this stuff. And I don't do that anymore. And I've experienced it as kind of liberating because I can focus on the things I think are important rather than having to deal with constant petty drama between personalities and this guy thinks this is good or bad and this doesn't agree with my ideology. All that stuff, you know, you're sort of like an HR manager on a work floor. It's terrible stuff. So I experienced it as a little bit liberating to be away from the movement. I've never been away completely from the movement, of course, but at least in a sort of a leading capacity to focus on making content and so on. And I've never had the success you had in that sense, so I don't know what it's like to experience such a drop in audience, of course. You still there? I think Woz has some kind of connection problem. I'm the only one left at this point. That's sort of awkward.
Welkom bij de Millennial Zorgenshow 2021. Dit is nu een overname van het Nederlands nationalisme. Welkom allemaal. Stel jullie vragen alstublieft. Wilhelmus van Oranje ben ik van Dietzen bloed. Den vaderland getrouwe ben ik tot in den dood. Then I don't remember the lyrics of the rest of the national anthem, which is kind of embarrassing, isn't it? Anyway. I do hope you have some... tell us a joke. Okay, I'll see if I can remember a good joke. Yeah, there's a guy chopping wood in the forest and an Indian comes by. And he asks the Indian, do you think there'll be a severe winter this year? The Indian looks around and he says, yes, I think it will be. So the guy chops a lot more wood. And then another Indian comes by. And then he asks the Indian, do you think it'll be a severe winter this year? And Indian looks around and he says, yeah, I think it will be a pretty severe winter. And a third Indian comes by. The guy's chopped a load of wood. And he asks the Indian, so do you think it'll be a severe winter this year? And the Indian says, yeah, I think it will be a very severe winter this year. And the guy thinks and he asks the Indian, how do you Indians know so well what kind of weather it will be? And the Indian says, well, we look around and we look at the size of the wood piles in front of people's houses.
Right. Hello. I'm back. My computer crashed, so I apologize. This was inevitably going to happen at some point. It might well happen again during Millennial.
Sorry about that. We have decided that this is now Dutch Millennial. Millennialische zorgen, and I am only answering questions in Dutch now.
Oh my God! I think you've had too much Gouda.
Gouda is not our best cheese. You always talk about Gouda and Edam, which
I don't like Edam. It's very bland. But I do
you know,
Gouda.
Funny things, I like French cheeses. I do like Camembert and Roquefort.
Is this an admission, a confession that you want to be making on air? Are you sure? Mm.
Well, I can just say that we could colonize them.
All right. Just for the cheese.
The cheese. The rest, not so much.
Okay, there's one last question and then we'll wrap up because we need to... Yeah. I try to keep these streams fairly brief and concise and punchy.
Yeah. Well, concise has at this point failed.
Yeah. What is Faust's MBTI score? Is that Myers?
What is MBTI?
Let me see. Oh, it's the it's the Myers-Briggs personality test. It's the 16 types.
Oh, I have no idea. I am relatively aggressive, very conscientious.
That's the five personality traits.
I know.
Yeah. Hold on a second. I'll tell you 16 personalities. If you do this test and then you can let everyone know.
I don't think I care.
but your fans do.
Oh, well.
I've sent you.
Don't believe in democracy, woes, so they can go stuff themselves.
Okay.
To give the masses what they want, you should only do that if it favors whatever goal you're trying to achieve. You should be a demagogue, not a Democrat.
Well, okay. You're probably an INTJ or ENTJ. That's what I would guess. But
it means nothing to me.
Yeah. What do I know? All right, let's end it there. Could you summarize what you were saying earlier about the point about COVID drowning out all other issues and what it's achieved for the elites?
Well, what it's achieved for the elites is that it has basically neutralized every other political opposition, right and left, right? Environmentalism has been made secondary. All these talks about social inequality, like racism, you still hear about it, but does it have the same traction in the media? No. Populism sidelined and divided on the whole vaccination issue. Every group that exists in society first has to take a position on whether they're in favor of vaccination, what they think about COVID, and then they can make their argument. That's sort of what it has achieved. It has completely marginalized every other issue in favor of this particular one, and this particular one is dictated by whatever the media chooses to bring out. There's a new variant. Oh, there's an issue with the vaccine, or there's not an issue with the vaccine, or there's this many dead, or there's not that many dead. Depends entirely on what the media wants to tell you, whether or not you're going to be talking about it, because you will be talking about it, because people at your work will be talking about it, the people on the podcast you're listening to will be talking about it, everyone will be talking about it. So you've got to take a position on it, and your own personal concerns about economics, about environment, all secondary. So in that sense, it's just a masterstroke of completely sidelining everything else.
Yeah, it's sort of bread and circuses to keep people occupied, but because it's an endless, like a soap opera. So there's always new stuff to talk about with it. But at the same time, it is something that is relevant and important, and that has it, because it's not just bread and circuses in the sense that it's meaningless drivel. It does have real implications. Yeah. But as you said, it cannot be allowed to dominate everything else. Everything in moderation, I guess, in sense of proportion. Yep. Okay. All right. Well,
I will wish all of your listeners a happy Sinterklaas. That's already passed, but it's a better party to be celebrating than Christmas. And if you're European, look up your own native traditions before celebrating things like Christmas and Halloween, which are American imports.
Oh, come on. Don't be ridiculous. Christmas isn't an American import. Come on. You're not going to blame that.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Right. You've got enough. Yule in Scandinavia. We've got Sinterklaas. You've got the Julebok and so many other traditions. Christmas, as it is today, is a commercial American introduction to try and get you to spend money on their disgusting plastic toys.
On that issue of our own festivals, I do like Guy Fawkes Night in Britain.
Yeah.
Bonfire Night. And I did a video about it earlier at the time, the 5th of November. And I would ask people to go and watch that because I was very proud of it at the time. So that is something. And as you say, it's something that is unique to Britain. It's something that doesn't involve any other countries, really. So it's nice. I'm really glad that we have that. And because we don't seem to have many other unique festivals.
I'm sure if you went looking, you could find them.
But that's the point. They're obscure now. And they shouldn't be.
Yeah, I made a magazine edition. I published a Dutch language cultural magazine. I made a magazine edition about our whole cycle of winter festivals. We have like seven, of three of which are entirely pagan and four of which are half pagan, half Catholic sort of mixture. But there's plenty if you go looking. I'm sure that you can find plenty of Celtic stuff, and especially as a Scotsman, right? There must be plenty of Scottish tribal and such traditions, clan traditions you could find.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, again, it's a complicated issue because there's the whole thing about, does that connect with people anymore?
Next year, I expect you to be wearing a tartan, that you've researched the entire genealogy of your clan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, let's not get into that now. That's a whole other issue. All right. Okay, so let's end it there. Faust, thank you very much for appearing on Millennial 2021.
It was a pleasure.
Okay, and I will be back in a little over half an hour with Snorkel. I think it is Snorkel. Yeah, Snorkel Blog next. So, okay, I'll see you then. Bye-bye for now.
Long live the Kaiser.
Thank you, Faust.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.